Hello and welcome to Hometown Alaska. I'm Dave Waldron. Well, don't let the May snowfall fool you. It is definitely growing season in Alaska. And on today's show, we'll be discussing the challenges and rewards of gardening in our northern climate, answer some listener questions, and do a little bit of gardening trivia. Later in the show, we're going to visit an apple orchard to find out what goes into their growing process this time of year. But right now in the studio, we have two master gardeners. Emily Becker and Nick Reardon are both with the group Alaska Master Gardeners of Anchorage. Welcome to you both.
Thank you.
Yeah, pleasure to be here.
Thanks for coming in. Well, let's start super simple. What is a master gardener and how does one become a master gardener?
So the Master Gardeners are a program of the Cooperative Extension, which is a program of UAF. So it's out of, it's connected to the Fairbanks campus because it's a land-grant university. And the land-grant universities across the country have the Extension Service. And I always like to tell people the Extension Service is a bridge between the university and just regular people. And it started really to help farmers, you might have these scientists who were, researching the boll weevil or something like that, and they'd have all this great research, and they needed to get it out to people so that it would be useful. So we help take the information from the university scientists and bring it to the people and regular gardening information. So it's a great organization. It's also, so to be a master gardener is also, it's a community service organization. So when you commit to being a master gardener, you are also committing to taking that knowledge and helping other people.
Well, that's great. I mean, if it was me, it would just be all for the ego. I need to be a master of something.
It is. It's the word. It's unfortunate. I feel like the word master is intimidating. And really, we're kind of all regular gardeners. And, you take the Master Gardener class. It's just a regular class. So like, I think 40 hours of education. And then you do 40 hours of community service. Am I getting that right?
Yeah.
I'm like, no, I forget. You have to do 40 hours of community service in order to get your certificate as a Master Gardener. But that's really just the beginning. I mean, you're expected to continue learning and to continue serving the community.
Well, what made you want to do it, Emily?
Wow, that's such a great question. I mean, I love growing food. I'm definitely a vegetable gardener. And anybody can attend Master Gardener meetings. Our monthly meetings are open to anyone. You don't have to be a Master Gardener. And going there, meeting people like Harry Duber and Jane Baldwin, just like my gardening heroes, people that I really just loved and respected. And I was like, oh, I want to do that.
And what about you, Nick?
As Emily said, the fact that it's a service-based organization, I find that really appealing. It's a great way to share with your community and connect with others. The format is gardening. That's the topic of choice, of course. And that's something that I'm equally passionate about. I think as someone, not a master, but someone wanting to learn, mentors are where it's at, that you relate to people one-on-one or in group settings. The organization has workshops and classes, but the people I've met are folks that now years later, I'm on the phone with them sometimes with problems. I'm like, oh, shoot. Hey, there's this thing happening. And so
exactly,
that's mm-hmm. invaluable.
Mm-hmm. And I'm hoping we'll be able to do that for our listeners, answer some of those hard to answer questions. But just talking about the range of mastery. So you said, 80 hours, that's not a lot of time to become a master of something. That's pretty great. So there's going to be a lot of range in your mastery of gardening. Does AMGA offer different levels of the master title? Are there different tiers? Or is it just you're a master, you're not?
We actually do have the advanced Master Gardener certification. In fact, Nick's going to be teaching an advanced class this summer on composting. So to take the advanced class, you have to have already you received your regular Master Gardener certificate. But really, we offer continuing education all year. So different programs or, all kinds of things you can do. Our newsletter has articles. So we're always, that's part of what we do is educating people. And again, hopefully finding the correct information to get out to people that's, scientifically based and backed by good sources.
Well, this might seem like a super basic question, but what do we grow best here in South Central Alaska? And we can go to you, Nick.
When I think of Alaska, I often think of our weather and our seasons. And so in that context, picking plants that can handle our shorter summer really well. And so some shorter season crops are really perfect. Things that you probably are familiar with eating yourself, but all these cabbages and broccolis and cauliflowers, turnips, beets, radishes, rutabagas, potatoes are a classic. I think there's others too. How about you, Emily?
Yeah, I'm a big fan of kale. That's probably my favorite thing to grow. And carrots grow really well in Alaska. And that, I feel like there's like a reason for that. Nick, what is that? You know, why are carrots so good in Alaska?
Oh, yeah, the length of the amount of sunlight. The plants turn sunlight into sugar with a few other helpers along the way. And so sweetness is really appealing. You have the classic, ooh, vegetables. I don't want those. But when they have a higher sugar content, it's a little more compelling.
Yeah, I'll take an Alaska carrot over any carrot any day of the week. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about these master gardens. I'm sure you've seen a lot of them. When you think of gardening, it's so easy to just think about the plants and what's growing. But a large part of master gardening is landscaping and creating this space where these plants are actually going to grow. So let's talk about that.
The simplest way I approach gardens when first looking at them or thinking about them is often starting with, you know, what sort of light they have, what sort of wind they might have, how much water are you going to have? Like, is there a slope to the topography? There's sort of a list of criteria you'd approach and questions that you'd ask when looking at a space and trying to figure out what plants would grow best here. You can call it lazy gardening. You could call it wise gardening. But the tailoring what sort of things you want to grow to the place is something that I think will lend towards success.
Yeah, and garden design is its own, it's its own sort of artistic field. And, you know, if you're a vegetable gardener, maybe you're, you know, that's your thing. But if you're a flower gardener, maybe you're thinking about what colors you want to have, different, you know, combinations of colors and textures that look good to each other. One of our members, Brenda Adams, she lives in Homer. She's written 2 books about garden design for cold climates. And, you know, there's all kinds of resources out there for designing a garden. And I think people are getting away from lawns and thinking more about pollinators and helping your garden have an ecosystem where birds want to visit and insects are welcome. And I think people are learning more and more about that and making sure your plants are, like your garden is an inviting place for all kinds of critters and creatures.
Well, and landscaping seems like it could get really expensive really fast. What are some affordable ways that people can landscape their yards without spending a ton of money? Because I've seen some of those gardens that I followed some links on your website, and they were like very elaborate, like rock walls with like fancy plants growing out of the cracks. Like, how does someone do something like that without, you know, dropping a couple $1,000 at the depot?
You should go see Nick's garden in Midtown. It's the Spinard Community Garden. Is that what it's called?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. It's beautiful, and he's very cheap.
It's true.
Like, thank you.
I think one thing that helps keep the cost down is if you have time on your side, you can pay a lot of money and have it built, you know, this summer, or you can stretch it out over 10 years. So that will allow you to let things occur a little more naturally. I think that also avoids a lot of mistakes sometimes because you didn't catch everything that was going on in your yard or in your setting. And you also, you know, you change as a person too, and you learn things as you go. And so you can apply that a little better each year. It's nice to make small mistakes when you're doing that sort of thing, especially if where money is concerned.
Mm-hmm. You know, in Alaska, it's very common to have raised beds. And that is because, you know, it helps get the temperature of the soil higher a lot faster to have a raised bed. But you don't have to go buy cedar wood. You know, you can. Of course, it's really beautiful. And especially if you need a structure, like, you know, if you're gardening with kids, sometimes it's nice to have like, this is where the garden is and this is where the garden is not. But you don't need a container for a garden. People do build mounds of just, you know, of dirt, and you can do it lasagna style using all kinds of found ingredients. So you don't need to go out and pay a lot for a structure, and you don't need to pay a lot for dirt. You can do all of those things, you know, by using the resources around us. And Nick's group, ACAT, it has helped found, and along with Anchor Gardens, has got this cool garden depot on Chichaco Street, where I just went there this morning. And there's just mounds of compost and leaves and brewery waste and pots and all kinds of stuff that's available for free or by donation to anybody that wants it. So if you're gardening on the cheap, which is we're both cheapos, you know, I wouldn't buy raised beds. I would just build mounds, and I would go there for a lot of my ingredients. And I also go to Moose's Tooth, the Broken Tooth Brewery, and I pick up brewery waste all the time. There's lots of stuff out there for free if you've got the time to go get it.
What kind of brewery waste is there out there?
So spent grain, just from the process of brewing, you end up with this, you know, grain that's fermented, and they dump it out. And you have to, like, fight the farmers from the valley. They come in and they take it all away. But yeah, almost all the breweries around town have places where the public can go and get the spent grain and just put it into buckets and take it with you.
And then what do you do with it?
Well,
you can tell my level of gardening right now, can't you?
So, and Nick can correct me on this. So brewery waste is a high nitrogen amendment. So you'd want to, you know, mix that. I would say it's a great thing when you're making a lasagna bed to build in your soil. It's a great layer for your soil. It's really great in compost. Like, I got brewery waste and, like, I put some crab legs in there and some leaves, and that thing was cooking. It was like, you know, really awesome.
Yeah, I love composting. To back up a step, if your soil is healthy, if it's got a lot of microbes, a lot of soil critters going on there, it's an active ecosystem. It supports your plants. Your plants are happy. Different plants have different needs, so there's some nuance to that. But what makes happy, you know, happy soil ecology, having lots of organic matter and lots of nutrients available. That's what Emily's talking about with the brewery grains, the spent grain. And there's lots of other organic materials that you can get, and you can compost them and add that compost as a fertilizer. It's a good way to keep the cost down. It's a kind of a fun science experiment to do in your backyard. It's totally attainable, you know, in a lot of city lots in Anchorage. And yeah, mixing the right recipe, you know, takes maybe a practice or two. But yeah, it's in your backyard, so you check on it regularly, watch it heat up, watch it cool down, watch all the, like, worms and fungus make it a home again, and then you know it's ready to spread on the garden.
Are there easy ways to tell that your soil is healthy, like using worms or maybe bugs that tell you otherwise?
I've heard of worm censuses, kind of like the U.S. Census. You go around and you knock on doors and you see just how many worms are around. Uh-huh. That's one example. I think of worms as kind of like the whales, you know, the sort of the whales of the soil. And so, you know, they're feeding. They need a healthy ecosystem to support them. They're huge creatures by comparison to whatever the krill and the plankton and all the fish. So seeing worms there tells you that there are these littler bugs, these littler microbes are there in abundance.
And what about bad bugs? Are there bad bugs out there that you're like, oh, that's not good. We need to get rid of these.
That's a whole nother topic.
Right. Well, I mean, you know, yeah, of course. I can remember, I have a distinct memory of, you know, years ago when I was a beginning gardener, I had some broccoli that wilted. And I can't remember what, I remember distinctly it was Jan van den Top, who's our group treasurer. He was like, you have root maggots. And I was like, root maggots? That's so rude. So that's a very, very common one for beginning gardeners. They're like, my broccoli is wilting and I watered it and it's still wilting. And then you're like, does it wiggle in the soil? Uh-oh. You know, so root maggots have eaten it. Very, very common. You know, that's probably one of the biggest ones. And once you have root maggots, you're going to have them. So these are flies that lay eggs around the roots of your plant.
And do you see food and flowers separate a lot? Or it sounds like it's not really a separate thing. Like, people like to incorporate food into their flower gardens. What are some of the common things you see? What are some of the things that work really well together?
I would consider myself mostly a food gardener, but increasingly, because of these garden tours and going to the botanical gardens here in town, my eyes get really big when I see, yeah, like you said, the artistry and the beauty that is created. And so it inspires me to kind of venture out of my comfort zone or kind of initial passion with it. I already was incorporating some flowers into the food garden, edible flowers. I mean, nasturtium is a classic, and adding calendula and even kind of heading down the medicinal path a bit into things that you might want to dry and keep in oil to make kind of salves and stuff. You're already getting ready for winter when you see these flowers blooming. You can feel the cold wind.
Well, and that's the thing. Like, if you're a zucchini gardener, you've got to attract pollinators. So you're going to be planting flowers all around your garden so that you're attracting insects to come and get that job done for you. Because that's another big question. People are like, oh, my zucchini's rotting on the end. And it can be a lack of calcium, but it's usually not that. It's usually incomplete pollination, which means you just didn't have enough visitors to the flowers. And that's why your zucchini didn't grow. So you've got to attract those pollinators. And that actually brings me to, you know, we just had our Master Gardener conference, and I heard a great speaker there, Professor Justin Fulkerson from UAA, who's an entomologist. And just it was a great talk about insects in Alaska and how much we really don't know and how insect populations are suffering. So the more we can do as gardeners to help increase those populations is good.
What are some good resources or groups that are out there for the home gardener? I'm sure you know quite a few of those.
Yeah, I was going to say that our local cooperative extension has so many different resources and publications. Their catalog, when I flip through it, I see topics that they've covered that I didn't even realize I had questions about.
Questions leading to questions. Well, speaking of questions, we have some listener questions for you, if you're up for answering some. We have this one from Valerie. What are some plants that are indigenous to Alaska that I can use in my yard as a substitute for grass? So you're talking about that earlier, and people moving away from the lawn, moving into plants instead.
Instead of grass. I mean, in my yard, I've got ground cover, and I use nagoonberry, which spreads really well. Like the dwarf dogwood spreads really well. Lupin, ferns. I mean, if you're talking about small plants, then I would look to, you know, some ground cover things that are really common. And it is hard to purchase these things. And of course, we don't want people going into the woods and just digging stuff up. but the Wildflower Garden Club has a plant sale the first Saturday in June. And they have lots of their members have native plants for sale. So that's a great place to go. And I actually, the Anchorage Soil and Water Conservation District is just starting a program on native plants because there is a demand for like a native plant nursery so people can go and buy these things legally and get them into their yards. So check back in like a year or so. Hopefully we'll have more resources for people. Can you think of other?
Yeah, I would reiterate, starting small is good. Sometimes you might, let's say you just bought a house and you're looking out over 4,000 square feet of what was lawn. And like, oh, that's a little intimidating. Start with a little, you know, 8x8x4, even go big, 10x10 or something. And you can try to remove the sod. That's a little challenging, but you can also bury it under this kind of organic matter, lasagna garden style, or even just tarp it. But, you know, let it sit for a year. With organic matter on top of it and plant in it as you go. I personally find, especially if you're trying to replace grass can be really competitive with other plants. And so I like to fight fire with fire, so to speak, and insert things that both I want, but that are going to be able to stand their ground.
We have another one. Our next listener asks, how do I get fireweed to grow in my planter?
How do you get it to not grow? I love fireweed. That's definitely one I have in my yard, and I use it to make tea. It's also great, you know, eating the shoots of it. It's a great edible plant. I would think, you know, it grows a lot by rhizomes, but if you collect the seeds in the fall and just put them down where you want them to go, my guess is it would probably do its thing.
I like Emily's idea of using the seeds. I think a key element of that is so disturbed soil so the seeds can germinate without competition, and then knowing what baby fireweed looks like. Mm-hmm. And so when you do see things popping up, you can say, oh, I want to keep that one. I don't want to keep that one, and make the distinction.
We'll do one more listener question. This one is from Courtney. My tomato plants grow well and flower a lot, but I get few actual tomatoes. Do you have any tips to get more tomatoes from your flowers? And I definitely want to know this because this happened to me last year in my greenhouse, my tiny greenhouse.
So you have to be ruthless. You can't let every flower try to go to fruit. You got to prune those tomatoes. You got to prune them. And there's probably like a 101 YouTube videos on pruning tomatoes. You have to know, first of all, if your tomato is determinate or indeterminate, which is pretty easy. You can check the seed packet or, you know, look at the morphology of the plant. But then you got to prune it, because if you have too many branches, too many flowers, the plant doesn't have the energy to put all of those to fruit. And it is, it's like a sad thing to do. Like, it's usually the end of July, early August, and you're like, this is it. No more growing. We're focusing on fruit now. And then you got to just be brave and cut it.
Yeah.
Tough love.
Sounds a hard thing to do for something you've been watching grow.
It is. It's really, and you feel attached to every single one of those flowers.
Yeah. It's hard, the burden.
It is.
You could be a tomato someday. Okay, we are now going to enter the game show portion of today's program.
Sweet.
This is a segment that we are calling Stump a Master Gardener. We will put not only your practical knowledge of gardening to the test, but your trivial knowledge as well. Either contestant can answer, and listeners will know if you answered correctly by our applause simulator or the sound of a stump. Are you both ready?
We're ready.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Bring it.
What are the three most common wild roses that grow in Alaska?
Can I use my phone? No, I'm just kidding.
You may not use your phone.
It's like the scientific name is kind of stumping me. So we have the Arctic rose, which is our native rose.
Check.
And then the Sitka rose, which is the one that escaped the experiment station.
Check.
And then is it rugosa is the third one?
That's not what I have, but I'm not a master gardener.
Okay. What is it
called? So you're probably right. For the third one, I had it listed as either wild or Nootka.
Oh, Nootka. Nootka is a native one.
Native to Alaska.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. We are definitely going to give that one to you. You got two, probably three out of three there.
Yes.
Up next, what is the most poisonous flower in Alaska?
Ooh, it's the water hemlock, I think.
Ooh, that does sound very poisonous.
It is. I got to see some of it in person in Bethel this year, like extremely poisonous plant.
Water hemlock, that's your final answer.
What's its scientific name? Gosh, I should know this. There's water hemlock, and then I would say in the forested regions, baneberry.
Mm-hmm. No, water hemlock was right, yeah. Up next, how much did the record-holding pumpkin at the Alaska State Fair weigh? You do not have to get the exact pound. I would accept anything within 100 pounds.
Within 100 pounds. I know it's over 1,000.
Yeah, I was going to guess 1,400.
But, yeah, let's go with that. Let's do 1,450.
Is this the price is right? Yeah.
We can turn it into that. Would you like to do an over and under attempt?
I'm happy with that answer.
1,450?
1,600? that's all I've got.
The answer was 2,000.
Oh, it is over a ton.
147 pounds.
Dang.
Almost.
I'm sorry. I apologize to the pumpkin grower.
So. It is very impressive. What famous author once wrote, "A cauliflower is nothing but a cabbage with a college education"?
I like that.
Famous author.
You may have read this author in high school, you know, just throwing that out there.
J.D. Salinger.
Forced high school reading. Okay, that's your answer. All right. All
right. I don't know.
It was Mark Twain.
Oh, shucks, I should have known that. That does sound like him.
Okay, next up, we're going to play a short song clip.
Okay.
So this is an audio test. It's in relation to gardening. Let me know if you recognize it.
Seal, kissed
Seal
by a rose.
Nailed it. I knew that one might be easy. So
we're both Gen X.
I've got one that might be slightly harder and is a slightly shorter clip. We'll play one more.
Built You Up Buttercup.
Oh, man, that was fast.
That was the Foundations.
The Foundations. Okay, yes, mm-hmm. Yes. All right. Nailed them both. All right. Last question here. This is either a riddle or a terrible pun. I'll let you decide later. Why should you avoid arguing with a cactus?
I feel like I'm supposed to say, I don't know, David. Why should you avoid arguing with a cactus?
I'd like to clarify, it is not a knock-knock joke. Okay. No call for response.
They're very sharp.
Great answer.
They have great points.
You got it. They have too many great points. Although I would argue that your first answer was also correct. Okay. Well, that concludes our Stump a Master Gardener segment. I'd like to thank both of my guests with the group Alaska Master Gardeners of Anchorage, Emily Becker and Nick Reardon. Thank you both for talking with me and putting up with some silly questions at the end there.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks a lot.
After this break, we'll visit an apple orchard in downtown Anchorage and meet the head of a local fruit growers association. I'm Dave Waldron, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media. Welcome back to Hometown Alaska. I'm Dave Waldron, and today we're meeting some of the top gardeners and growers in Anchorage. Right now, we're here with Mark Wolbers at his home and personal orchard here in East Anchorage. He is the president of the Alaska Pioneer Fruit Growers Association, a nonprofit group of farmers and growers. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So your garden is pretty impressive. You walk into your backyard and immediately you just see trees on the left, trees on the right, and you've got these small like fruit raised beds that you're doing raspberries and strawberries in, but it's really smart use of space. There's no tree that's too much higher than the tree that's next to it, and you can walk through the whole thing, so it's kind of like it's got a really nice path running through the whole thing that you can kind of explore each little nook and cranny.
The space, when we bought the house, we moved in here in 2009. This was all birch woods in the back here, starting basically about where you're standing and all the way back. And so the next year in 2010, we cleared it. My wife, Miok, designed the layout of all the gardens, and she was more or less in charge with this side of the yard. I got stuck with the boring production side of the yard. And our goal was to have something that not only was productive, but was, you know, aesthetically pleasing to be in.
Tell us a little bit about the APFGA. What is it that they do?
Well, we basically, our organization was started back in 1980, mid-80s, and with the idea that trying to figure out ways to actually grow fruit here in Alaska and find out what things actually worked and what were best practices and that sort of thing. Because unlike many states in the lower 48, we do not have a robust extension service in our universities that are basically completely focused on fruit production. We're lucky that we still have some extension service people, and we hope that everybody writes their state legislature and tells them to support the university, because the extension service comes out of that university budget and is really important resource for people. But we kind of fill in that gap. And so in a sense, my role is kind of serve as a pseudo extension agent for people who are interested in growing fruit. And they join Alaska Pioneer Fruit Growers for a modest $16 a year. And with that, we have a whole variety of activities and educational events for them, as well as resources that they can reach out to. So we usually start off in the spring. We start off with a grafting workshop, which we just had April 15th. So maybe they have a crab apple and they'd like to have some edible apples on it, and we show them how to do that. We do pruning workshops, teaching people how to take care of their mature fruit trees. And then we'll do orchard tours during the summer. And in the fall, we lead into apple pressing. So we help our members press their apples for cider and juice, if that's what they'd like to do. And then we have fruit tasting, so people can sample the apples if they're thinking about they want to get into developing an orchard for themselves. They can sample the apples that are being grown locally, learn which ones they really like, talk to the growers, and find things that match both their location and their taste. And then the cycle kind of starts over again. The next spring, they can then come to the grafting workshop, get that cyanwood or the variety they tasted at the apple tasting event, and now they can graft it and have that tree growing in their own yard. So,
well, tell us a little bit about grafting. That's a super cool, like, Frankenstein-y thing that growers get to do. How does that work? How do you graft one variety of apple tree to another?
Sure. Well, let me show you. So here on the deck, So I have basically I have four apple trees sitting here on the deck. These are
in four different pots, right?
Four different pots, and these are four different rootstocks. So every fruit tree is a combination of a rootstock, and then the variety that you want to eat is growing on top of that rootstock. So there's at least two parts to just about every fruit tree. There are some exceptions, like I have an Evans cherry in my orchard that's on its own rootstock, but generally anything that you buy in a store that's commercially propagated, it's going to be a rootstock, and then it's going to be cloned with a clonal of whatever variety it is. So way back when, like, you know, when the delicious apple was first discovered, there was one delicious apple. And every delicious apple can basically trace itself back as a clone back to that original tree. And so here what I'm doing is I'm experimenting with three different rootstocks that are, three of which are clonal rootstocks, which are now the modern standard for apple growing, and trying to see if any of these are actually suitable to our climate. So I've tortured them over the winter, purposely trying to kill them. So I have them in pots. They stayed out against the side, north side of my house without any snow cover all winter. And if they come alive in the next couple weeks, yay, we have a rootstock winter. If they're dead, well, back to the drawing board. But on these, I have grafted Prairie Magic, and I grafted the same variety on all four of these. This one here, you can see I grafted, because my cyanwood was smaller than the rootstock, I grafted onto the side here.
So it was growing straight up, and it's pretty clear that it breaks off to the
right
at, a different angle, and that's where you grafted it?
Yep, that's the cyan.
Okay.
And then this grew out of it, and I've topped it to cause branching this year if it's alive. Right now in Alaska, we grow all of our apple trees. We bring up about 2,000 rootstock every year as a club for our members to grow and propagate root trees. This year was 1,700 of that was apple, and it's all what they call seedling apple rootstock, which means it's grown from seed, which means it has all the variabilities of seed. So that could be the size, it could be the vigor, it could be the hardiness, it could be the grafting compatibility, it could be the root development, disease resistance, you name it. You don't know what you got because it's seedling. Mm-hmm. But you do know that chances are it's pretty hardy, and most of the time it's hardy to like zone two, and so it'll grow as far, you know, we have people growing this up in Fairbanks. So the goal here is to try to find a replacement rootstock for that, because seedling rootstock is kind of going the way of the dinosaur, and every commercial orchard, lower 48, is now growing on clonal rootstock, and so that's what's being produced.
Well, Alaska definitely has a reputation as a veggie grower, right? We have these carrots and potatoes that are pretty awesome, and anyone that's been to our state knows about the kind of pumpkins we grow, if they've been to the state fair. But fruit here is kind of a different story. Is it a challenge to grow fruit here compared to other states? I mean, it feels like it is, or is that just a misconception?
Yes and no. So on the plus side, I can grow everything up here fairly organically because we don't have any of the insect pressure or the disease pressure that's prevalent in the lower 48 yet. That's not to say with changing climate that we don't get affected at some point, but for the most part, I don't have to spray my apples for insects or, you know, worms or any of that sort of thing. And luckily, we don't have the dreaded spotted wing Drosophila, which is a fruit fly which is just ravaging the fruit industry in the lower 48. It's just causing them to spend a lot more money trying to control it and maintain quality of fruit. So that's the plus side. The downside of growing in Alaska is, or the challenge, I should say, is that it's a short season. And so we basically, our full growing season is basically the same as what the earliest commercial produced apple is in the lower 48. So there's a variety called Zestar. That's the earliest commercial variety produced in the lower 48. That is a late season apple for us. That's a early October apple. And our season, of course, can end really abruptly in September. So like not this past fall, but the previous fall, our growing season came to end, I think it was on September 20th, and I had 20 degree temperatures here in the orchard at night. And so I was out frantically picking all my fruit the night before. I actually had people coming over to help me just to get everything pulled off the vines and bushes and get it brought in.
I don't think it's really a secret what we grow well here, right? We grow apples, we grow raspberries, we grow blueberries. What are some of the fruits that people would be surprised to know that we can actually grow pretty well here?
Well, I think if you talk to somebody in the lower 48, they'd be surprised to know that we're actually growing things like apples, right? But outside, you have limitations. If you have what they call a greenhouse or a high tunnel, you know, that, of course, allows you to capture more heat units, and then you can grow more things. And depending on what low temperature you limit it to, then you could have, you know, figs growing. You know, if you kept the low temperature not going below, you know, 32, you know, during the wintertime in a greenhouse, you could be growing figs, not a problem, right? I have citrus in our living room, right? But outside, that's what we pretty much primarily focus on, is, you know, trying to figure out what can you grow outside and how can you do it. So let me show you, if you don't mind, we can walk and I can show you some examples.
Sure, that'd be great. Yeah. Okay.
Down here in this blank space, that will be a Asian pear, actually. So if you want to ask me about, well, what's the most unusual fruit I expect to be growing, it's going to be probably that Asian pear. But it's a recent release out of the University of Minnesota, and it's supposed to be hardy zone 3, and it's supposed to have a season that matches what we can do up here. So that will be going in probably midsummer. So here's a cherry tree that I'm experimenting with. There's a variety called Black Gold. And again, it was planted last year. It's on a Crimps 5 rootstock. I'm waiting to see if this actually lived and made it through the winter. I've tried grafting this before in other places in my yard, and it could be that East Anchorage is a little bit too cold for this variety, but so far, looking good. So if this cherry is successful, you can see I've got it in a tight spot. I've got a mature apple tree to the left, behind it, and over here will be a pear. And a pear gets to be the same size as an apple. So I'm going to need to grow this in a compact shape. And so what I'll do is what they call a KGB method of pruning on it, where I'll top it at 18 inches, and basically the top four buds will come out and grow this season as branches. And then next year, I'll cut those back to about 5 or 6 inches, and off of those, four or so branches will come off of each one of those. So then I'll have like 16 or 20 of these branches coming up, and they'll grow up, and as they grow, they grow up pretty much vertically, mm-hmm. as opposed to horizontal branches. And so I can have a lot of fruit by doing that kind of a training system on the tree. I can have a lot of fruit in a relatively small area.
Pruning seems like it's an art of its own. Talk a little bit about how to prune a tree properly.
I would say that pruning is a bit of an art, and that and I've helped out friends, like just this fall or this spring, I went over to a friend's house and helped them prune a bunch of Norlin apple trees that were quite old, that the moose had browsed on year after year after year, and they were just kind of scraggly and not looking very good. And so the main thing with pruning is that you want to get light penetration into the canopy where the fruit's going to be. Wherever the canopy is so thick that it blocks light, you won't get flower buds. And so that's why on an old apple tree, if you look at an old apple tree, all the fruit is moved to the outside perimeter of the tree and is no longer in the center part of the tree. So if you look at my trees, you'll notice that they're very open, right? We joke in the club that a well-pruned apple tree, you can throw a cat through. Not that you would, but that's what the saying is, for whatever reason. I don't know, someone had an extra cat laying around, apparently. And then, you know, I top them so that I can stand on the ground and reach everything without a ladder. So pruning is a little bit of an art, and there are different forms of pruning that you can do for different shapes of trees. So all of these apple trees are what we call a central leader form, but you can have an apple tree that's what they call a vase shape or an open center. And so basically the trunk comes up, and then maybe, you know, 2 or 3 feet above the ground, the trunk splits into like four or so main branches going up, and so it has this open vase quality. But again, it's all about having light penetration in there.
What's your best advice to someone that sees an apple tree at Costco and is like, I want that in my yard? And obviously, they probably shouldn't just dig a hole anywhere and plop it in there. What are the steps they should take before they just plant a tree in their yard?
Well, I swear, the only reason I'm good at my job that I do here for the fruit growers is that I've made all the stupid mistakes already, and now I'm just telling people what not, you know, what to do, because I've tried it and I felt stupid later. My first apple trees were on a previous property, and they were impulse buys from a store. Didn't know what rootstock they were on, Didn't know if the varieties would actually ripen here in Alaska. Didn't even know if I'd like the apple that came off of, because I'd never tasted that apple. And so my biggest advice to people is, well, hold your horses. You are better off joining an organization like ours, seeing what people do, seeing what it looks like, tasting it, and then grafting it to a rootstock that you know is going to work in your soil conditions and your environment. And then you have an apple tree that's really going to do great. I recently was in Costco, and I saw a tree with multiple varieties on it, Gala, Liberty, Honeycrisp. They were all too late of season apples to grow here in Alaska. It's a Zone 3 plant. I went up, talked to the manager. I said, you did a great job. You picked Zone 3 plants, but unfortunately, nobody's going to get a ripe apple off of these trees. And the rootstock is bud weight and bud 118, which if you have heavy soils, may not really like it there in the long run and may just peter out after a couple of years. So I guess what I would say is that, you know, you want to do this work because it is work to clear a space for an orchard. And I usually recommend people take a year, clear the space, get the soil tested, amend the soil, because some of the nutrients that the fruit trees are going to want in the long run, like phosphorus, are not mobile. It's really hard to get it into the ground after you've got your orchard planted. And then come back the next year, right, and plant some trees. In the meantime, you can be grafting, but you can grow the trees in a pot over a year and then have them ready to go out to your orchard the following year or whatever.
How do you keep the moose out? Because your fence is pretty tall, but I've seen moose jump taller fence than this pretty easily. I would say about a 5-foot fence. So what do you do to keep the moose out? And has a moose ever gotten in here and just had a feast?
No. No, the joke in the club is that a 6-foot fence is good for a lazy moose. Right? And when you've got apple trees are the moose's favorite food. Don't even think about planting any kind of fruit trees unless you can fence it off and have it prevent moose from getting into it. Luckily, they've never tried to hop over the front where the gate is. So knock on wood, but yeah, we try to keep them. Definitely got to keep them out of here, because once I got them in here, I don't know how to get them out.
Gardening can be pretty intimidating when you're first getting started, right? These plants, they die easy. The soil and the mulch and the starters can all be really expensive. So what are some small steps that people can take if they're just getting into growing? And I'm guessing this is a good chance to plug your group.
The fruit growers will give you some advice, you know, that will help increase your chances. But I tell everybody, you know, if you're not killing trees, you're not trying, right? And a lot of things can kill a tree. Right. We talked about moose, right? Basically at every level, there's an animal that wants to eat on your apple tree. At the top are moose, right? On top of the snow are rabbits. If you have rabbit populations, they will strip the bark off your tree. And down at the bottom are what we call voles, or they're kind of like mice, little critters. And they'll come crawling along in between the snow and the ground. And if they find your tree, they will girdle it and they will kill it. And so you can lose a tree for a lot of reasons, in addition to just the climate. You know, you could have a really bad year, and maybe things that, you know, appeared hardy are not hardy, or especially young trees can be more affected. Accidents can happen. You know, maybe you whack it with your weed whacker accidentally or something. And, so you can kill things with a number of ways. And none of that's bad. I mean, you get better at it. Each time something dies, you figure out, like, well, I need to do something different here next time. And that's part of the learning curve. But the fruit growers, you know, we've all killed our share of stuff. And so we share that information pretty freely about how to do things, you know, pretty successfully.
What are these different zones? You mentioned the zones a lot. What are the different numbers, and what is the best plants to grow for the zone we're in?
Well, Anchorage has a variety of zones. It's hard to talk about one zone. So like Anchorage kind of ranges, you know, if you're up on the hillside, you're probably zone 3. You might even be, if you're far enough up, you might be actually technically a zone 2. And that's about, you know, how cold a temperature do you get in the wintertime. And of course, if you're on the west side of Anchorage, you're probably a 4. Right. And maybe even brushing into the low 5 if you're in a really sweet microclimate. But that's part of it, is that everybody has to figure out what their microclimate is. And knowing the zone isn't enough. Like I was talking about those Costco trees, you know, those are all zone three. They would all pretty much live here in Anchorage, and they'll live year to year to year, but you'll never get a ripe apple off of them, right? So there's two things. There's the zone, and then there's a length of the season required for when that fruit's going to crop. And that information is not, unfortunately, is not available. So the only way you know that is talk to somebody, right, who's grown it or has tried it or knows how long, how many heat units that apple takes to reach maturity. So like here, you know, I've got a temperature logger here in my orchard. And so I can track and I can calculate how many heat units, or what we call growing degree days, that I'm experiencing here. And that basically tells me when things are going to flower. I can predict when I'm going to have flowering. I'm going to predict when my various fruits are going to come ripe. I even can predict events like cracking in cherries if the weather's wet. Because if cherries get to a certain point of development and then we get those full summer rains, then cracking can become an issue for some of those. So, you know, it's that kind of knowledge that's the devil in the details. And if we had more of that, then you can make more, no pun intended, apple-to-apple comparisons, right, about, you know, will this tree work here, you know, in this particular area? And you could look at a particular area, know how many heat units you're going to get, and then you could find trees that are appropriate for it.
Well, what about the chickens? We've got chickens running around here. What role do they serve in your garden?
They're our pets. And, yeah, they're just fun to have around, and they give you breakfast, you know. So, you know, what better pet could you have, right?
They don't mess with the apple trees at all? Because you're saying top to bottom, everyone loves an apple tree, but not the chickens?
The chickens, actually, they like the pressed apple after I'm done making cider. Okay. If I bring back some pressed apple, they like to eat that. They like the berries. And I've actually seen them poach an occasional raspberry. They have a fondness for the yellow raspberries. And even my little cherry tree here, I've seen them poach cherry off of there. So every now and then they do something. But for the most part, they're pretty well behaved. So.
Well, I want to thank Mark Wolbers, the president of the Alaska Pioneer Fruit Growers Association, for joining me today and for inviting me to your orchard. Thanks, Mark.
You're very welcome.
After this short break, we'll be back with State of Art. I'm your host, Dave Waldron, and you're listening to Hometown Alaska on Alaska Public Media.
From Alaska Public Media, this is State of Art. Welcome to State of Art on Hometown Alaska, your weekly dose of Anchorage arts and culture. I'm Ammon Swenson. Coming up, we'll hear about Anchorage Community Theater's production of the thriller Wait Until Dark. It tells the story of a blind woman who gets caught up in a game of cat and mouse with dangerous criminals. We're joined by director Krista Schwarting and lead actor Kachin McCrae to find out more. Schwarting speaks next.
So I actually really sat out more than the pandemic as a director. I'd been directing about two shows a year. And my last show that I directed opened more than 3 years ago. Kachin was actually in it as well. And I didn't really want to come back to directing until there was something I felt compelled by and that would challenge me. And I saw Wait Until Dark. I saw a professional production of it when I was about 13 years old. And I have really vivid memories of seeing it. And so that was one of the things that drove me back to directing.
Well, how about you, Kachin?
Sure. So I've had a bit of a relationship with the show for many years. When I was in high school, my high school did a production of the show and I just worked backstage on it. And then when I was in college, a local community theater did a youth production of the show as well, and I stage managed it. So it was a show that I had been pretty familiar with for a while. My dad introduced me to it and we watched the movie together to, you know, see what it was all about when I was a kid. It's a massively technically challenging show. And in particular, I think the challenges of acting the main role of Susie between being blind and then also the complexity of a thriller and all of the moving pieces that go into that.
You do play this lead character, Susie Hendrix. Could you maybe tell me about her and kind of some of that prep that you mentioned?
Sure. So Susie Hendrix is recently blind. She's been blind for about a year and has a, you know, relatively new relationship, very loving relationship with her husband. And she's obviously a very smart and capable woman, but she's also dealing with this new challenge in her life. And so when she is confronted with this situation of these con men who come into her life and think, oh, well, you know, this will be a relatively easy mark. And through the course of the show, you know, at first when you're seeing her, there's a lot of fear. There's a lot of sort of franticness to her interactions with the other characters as she's trying to, you know, wrap her head around what's going on. And the longer the show goes on, you get to see how very intelligent and how very perceptive she is and how she's really a much harder mark than you might expect her to be. And watching her sort of get the upper hand on these bad guys, I think is a really cool thing to portray.
Had you had any experience with, you know, associating with anybody who is blind or anything like that?
I don't think I have any personal experience with someone who is fully blind. You know, some people who have some visual impairments, but not anyone who is fully blind. I think that was a new thing of trying to kind of figure out what that would be like.
Yeah, totally. And I mean, as she's like a newly blind character, did you kind of bring some of that into your own portrayal?
Yeah, that was one of the things that I really spent a lot of time thinking about, you know, how many of her basic instincts that are based on having visual perception, how many of those instincts are still there, and how many of those instincts have really changed dramatically by relying on her other senses. So trying to sort of find the places where she might have an instinctive reaction as if a sighted person might have, how many places would her reactions really be fundamentally different based on this challenge that she's experiencing.
Well, Krista, so what were your main goals when you set out to direct this? I know you kind of wanted something that was attractive to you personally and whatnot, but yeah, what did you want to accomplish when you started this whole thing?
I've directed thrillers before, and I've also directed several farces, and oddly, they have some things in common. Pace matters enormously. If you ever get a thriller or a farce that there's just a lull, I mean, the whole illusion of it kind of dies. So I am attracted to that challenge. Any actor I've ever directed will tell you that I am really a stickler when it comes to pace. So there was that, but I also had a good friend when I was in graduate school who did go legally blind later in life. And I felt a lot of sympathy for Susie as a character. And I think the play actually underplays Susie's intelligence and doesn't give her a very round backstory. And trying to give the character that backstory in the performance. I mean, it is not in the script.
Yeah. And I mean, did you kind of have to kind of put in some of your own interpretations about this, you know, kind of self-reliant lady who, like, kind of how she got to this place?
Well, I think mostly it was that Kachin and I talked about it and how the script sort of shortchanges Susie in terms of her backstory. Literally, the only backstory we know is that she went blind a year ago and that she married Sam, her husband, 6 months after that. That's the entirety of Susie's backstory. Yeah. We don't know what she was doing with her life before then at all. And so I think we looked for places in the script that we thought there was a nuance of who she was as a person, both before and after she was blind.
Does anybody want to speak about the rest of the cast and crew that's involved?
Well, I would be incredibly deficient if I didn't mention the lighting designer, Dean Brady. If you've seen the movie, and again, I haven't seen the movie, but the last section of the play takes place in almost complete darkness. And he has given us a darkness that gives us these beautiful film noir shadows. And we can see just enough of the confrontation that comes in at the end that, you know, keeps us engaged in the play, I hope, as an audience member. Mark Stoneburner, who plays Rote, who is well known to audiences. He's at least in a show a year. Terrific actor. And I somehow could just see him enjoying the cat and mouse aspect of this part. But we also have two brand new actors in the cast that have done an amazing job. We have a man named Dakies Lyons, who had not acted since high school and is doing an amazing job as the third con artist. And a 13-year-old named Jasminka Jancic, who had literally never acted in anything beyond a skit at school. and is suddenly tossed into this fairly significant part of Gloria, who becomes Susie's sidekick as she's trying to negotiate what is happening to her.
One of the con men that we get to know the most is my character called Mike, played by Jacqueline Rowe. And I think very, you know, charming and charismatic and the more sympathetic of the three con men. And I think the relationship that develops between Mike and Susie, I think, is interesting and complicated. Mm-hmm. And so that's been fun to experiment with that with her.
Mike in the script is a man, and yeah. I made the choice for the character to be female. Mm. And the only things we changed really to make the character female were Mr. went to Mrs. That was essentially all.
Yeah. Any motivation behind that character swap?
Well, there's the basic idea that more than half the audition pool in Anchorage is female.
Totally.
And you are excluding an awful lot of talented women if you have one adult female role.
For sure.
So that was a big part of it. But there is a very tender, I'm going to use the word friendship, that develops between the two of them that I felt like had a female energy. Hmm. I was open to whether it was a man or a woman, but it was something I started playing with when I was in the preparation stage. And then Jacqueline turned out to audition, and I'm like, oh, well, there it is.
Well, I mean, it sounds like, Krista, you say you've done kind of thrillers or similarly paced stuff, like mentioning like farces and stuff. It's all kind of timing and kind of building type stuff. But I mean, how would you say this maybe compares to other stuff that you've done in the past?
This feels very technically complicated in a way that I haven't worked with in a while. I think there are over 200 lighting and sound cues in the show, and that the show itself, you know, taking out curtain speeches and so forth, the show itself with an intermission is just over 2 hours long. And really creating this illusion of darkness and the danger of darkness at the end of the show is very complicated.
How about you, Cajun? How does this compare? I mean, it seems like it is a fairly unique role to take on. So I guess, yeah, how does that compare to other roles that you've played?
Yeah, it's definitely a very different show than I have done. I don't know that I have done a thriller quite like this. I've done like some horror shows, but not really a thriller in this way. I don't want to keep going harping on the blindness so much, because I think there's more to the character than just that. But from an acting perspective, that is one of the most unique things about playing this role. So that has been very interesting. And then again, just the number of props that I interact with, the complexity of the lighting and the sound and everything is definitely, it's a more technically heavy show than I think I've ever done.
Is there anything maybe that you'd want potential audience members to know about either before or after going to the show?
What's interesting to me is the show is set in 1958, and there are certainly pieces of it that feel somewhat dated. But I also think as we have over, you know, the last four decades, more than that since it was written, the idea of a strong female protagonist has become more popular, and that's really what Susie is.
I very much agree. I think she is a very strong female role and, a feminine female role. You know, sometimes we think that strength has to come with like, you know, being able to physically challenge someone in a fight or, you know, those kinds. Those are certainly great female protagonists as well. But I think that she's a woman who uses her intellect and her perception. You know, she plays to her strengths. And that's really how she ends up coming out on top, is by knowing where her strengths lie and knowing how she can get the upper hand. And I think it's a very intelligent way of approaching it. And I think it's just really cool.
That was Krista Schwarting and Cajun McRae telling me about Anchorage Community Theater's production of Wait Until Dark. The show is Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays at 7 p.m. and Sundays at 3 p.m. through May 28th. And that's all for State of Art. I'm Ammon Swenson.
And that's all for our show today. Special thanks to Emily Becker and Nick Reardon with Alaska Master Gardeners of Anchorage, and to Mark Wolbers with the Alaska Pioneer Fruit Growers Association. I'm Dave Waldron, and thanks for listening.
Hometown Alaska is a production of Alaska Public Media, which is solely responsible for its content. Views expressed are those of the host and participants and do not reflect the underwriters or KSKA. Hometown Alaska's theme song, Lead Dog, is by Kevin Barnett from Eagle River. Learn more about Hometown Alaska and listen online at alaskapublic.org. Life Informed. This is Alaska Public Media.